Welcome back to the program. Well, it certainly may seem as if the social, political, and moral debates today are a kind of Tower of Babel, a kind of moral food fight. My guest, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, argues that there's a basic moral underpinning to it all, that the culture wars are really a way in which our own personal experience breaks out and defines itself into a kind of moral and political matrix that both traps and defines us, that these principles are universal and enduring, and that perhaps if we can better understand them, we can at least have compassion for the better angels of our opponents. Jonathan Haidt is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at New York University's Stern School. He's the author of the previous book, The Happiness Hypotheses, and it is my honor to have him here today to talk about his newest work, The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It's just out in paperback from Vintage, and it is my pleasure to welcome Jonathan Haidt to the program today. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you here. In many ways, we have always operated under this assumption that somehow our moral decisions, our political decisions, that somehow reason was profoundly involved. And it really turns out that intuition and instinct plays an even larger role.
That's right. My original research as a social psychologist was on how people came to their moral judgments. And when I entered the field of psychology in 1987, everybody was studying how kids did their moral reasoning. And here's a dilemma for you: should a man steal a drug to save the life of his wife if she's dying of a rare form of cancer and he can't raise the money? And then you listen to the kids, you write down what they say, you analyze their reasons, and you show, oh, well, here's why Tommy said this and Janie said that. But what I found from studying situations that were a bit more emotional, for example, a family's dog is killed by a car in front of their house. They decide to cut up the dog's body and cook it and eat it for dinner. What do you think about this? And what I found is that in these sorts of cases, emotion comes first. It drives reasoning. And you can argue with people all you want, they're not going to change their mind. So, you know, they start off saying, well, it's wrong because they'll get sick. And then you say, well, but if the meat is cooked, they won't get sick. So does that make it okay? And they never say, oh, yeah, in that case it's okay. Rather, they just say, oh, yeah, okay, let me find another reason. And this is a pretty good model for our moral and political arguments. How often do you change someone's mind by refuting their reasons? Not often.
And there are certain issues, it seems, and the more moral underpinnings they have, the more it is difficult to seemingly change someone's opinion about certain things. I mean, we see in our society today that when it comes to issues like abortion, capital punishment, issues that have a moral context, it's impossible to change someone's opinion.
Mm-hmm. That's right. If somebody really wants to know the right answer, you know, they think it's fastest to drive to the airport, let's say, and then you know that it's faster to take the subway or the train, whatever, and you give them reasons and evidence, they will change their mind because their opinion is not locked down by anything else. But if they think that gay marriage is wrong or they think that immigration should be unrestricted or whatever, any of those positions, and you give them evidence to the contrary, they're not going to change their mind because our moral positions are our team membership badges. If a liberal changes his mind about gay marriage or Obama's health care, if you change your mind on these key issues, you're going to be kicked out of the club. You're going to face some serious consequences from your friends, and vice versa, of course, for conservatives. These are tribal issues. These are tribal moral badges, and our opinions are not really free to vary as they are on factual issues.
Given, though, that these principles, and I want to talk about the five foundations of these principles in a moment, but given that they have been with us forever and given that they are so powerful, why is it we are seemingly seeing such profound effects from them today, more than ever in our political discourse, arguably?
That's right. Well, we certainly are more polarized now, and it's been increasing rapidly since the 90s, since the 1990s, and even earlier. And so what you have to do is, first, lower your expectations. I'm a psychologist who studies the long history of human evolution from morality, and I think it's a miracle that we can actually get along with people who are not our kin. It's a miracle that we have civilization at all. And you have to look at the forces that pull us together and the forces that rip us apart. When people are very similar, when they all share a language and a religion, and especially when they've just been through a war together, those are forces that really pull people together. And in the mid-20th century, America had all those things going for it. It had very low rates of immigration. It had, you know, it's always had ethnic diversity, but there was a long period with low immigration, so there was a sort of a centralized culture around the kind of the Protestant middle class culture. And we've just been through World War II. So the Greatest Generation was very cooperative. And then we have much more diversity in immigration, and that's good in many ways. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just pointing out that when you have less of a sense of shared culture, and when the baby boomers didn't remember World War II, their key experience in their teens and 20s was fighting each other over civil rights issues, the environment, Vietnam. So we changed generations from the most cooperative generation, which is the Greatest Generation, to really the most divided and sort of competitive generation, the baby boomers. And so that's one reason why our polarization has increased so much since the baby boomers took over politics from the Greatest Generation.
And underlying this is the idea that we don't start out with the clean slate in terms of our own mind, in terms of our own moral attitudes, that we often think we do.
Exactly. That's probably the biggest single idea in all of psychology for the last 50 years. 50 years ago, psychologists and many other social scientists thought that children are born as blank slates. And then if their parents, you know, teach them one set of values, they'll learn that. If they watch TV, they'll get other values, and they'll get written on their impressionable young minds. Well, once the twin study started coming out in the 1980s, studies of how identical twins are really similar to each other, even if they were separated at birth. Whereas fraternal twins, or rather I should say children adopted into the same house with no genetic relationship, they're not very similar, even though they're raised by the same parents. And what this has shown us is that everything about us is heritable. Whether you're liberal or conservative is rather heritable. If you have an identical twin separated at birth, you probably will have similar politics. So we're not blank slates. We're born with our personal temperaments, and some temperaments incline people to liberal ideas, some to conservative ideas. It's not your destiny, but it just makes certain ideas sound better to you.
And it's the way in which experience, the experience we have during our lives, brings out these various foundations that really is the key to how we evolve morally and politically.
Exactly. So the story starts with the sort of genetic temperament things I was just talking about. But as I said, that's not our destiny. We then go through our lives and we get sensitized to certain issues, certain things happen in our families. I think it's quite revealing, let's say, that Dick Cheney, even back in the 2000 election, Dick Cheney was much more open and tolerant about gay issues. Well, you know, he's got a gay daughter. And John McCain really broke with his party on the issue of torture. He was tortured for many years. So our personal experiences can show us things that members of our team don't see because they don't share that experience.
In many ways, it's the way genetics plays out. I mean, there's deep similarities, the way genes express themselves and the way our morality expresses itself through our experience.
That's right, because you have to see morality as being in part an evolutionary adaptation. It's a great trick that our species has. That's why we have civilization and chimpanzees don't. It's not because we're better tool makers. You can make tools all you want, but if you can't work together with thousands or millions of people, you're not going to get civilization. So it's in part an evolutionary development, but then it's also in part a historical and cultural development. I did research in India, and India is very, very different than the United States. They have all kinds of ideas of purity and pollution and hierarchy and caste ideals. But the amazing thing is how fast they're changing. As they get rich, and they've been a democracy for a long time, but as they abandon socialism and embraced free market ideas, it's generated a lot of wealth, also a lot of inequality. You can see their society changing so quickly. Their morality is changing quickly, too. So things are both evolved and genetic and innate, but also flexible, and they change within a decade or two.
It's also the way that morality both binds us and blinds us at the same time.
That's the idea that's most interesting to me. I'm a social psychologist, and so I'm always interested in all these sort of groupish things that people do. And so my book is about moral psychology, but the idea is once you understand moral psychology and how it binds us together, then you can understand politics, religion, sports, fraternities, singing groups, all these things people do that seem irrational. They seem like a waste of time. But people do all sorts of things to bind themselves into larger groups because it's fun. It just feels good to us. Our greatest joys come usually from merging with other people, not just, you know, one lover or spouse, but groups. We love having groups, and that's what the last third of my book is about.
when we try and figure out how those groups break down, there are five foundational principles that you lay out. Talk a little about those, Jonathan.
Yes. So when I did my work in India, I was working with an anthropologist, Richard Schwader, and what I was trying to figure out is why is it that morality is so variable around the world, yet at the same time, you find so many identical elements. And the metaphor that I used was that it's kind of like our taste buds on our tongue. So wherever you go on this planet, everybody has the same five taste buds: sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and MSG, or sort of a savory meat-like flavor. So we all have the same taste buds on our tongue, yet our cuisines differ. Indian food's really different from Midwestern American food, which is really different from Hawaiian food. And that's not because our tongues differ. It's because our cultural learning, our cultures have created a cuisine that has to please those tongues, but people then learn to appreciate different sets of flavors and spices. And morality is the same way. So the five taste buds are care, issues of, you know, care and harm and suffering. That's one. Two is fairness and cheating, all those issues. Three is loyalty and betrayal. Four is authority versus subversion. And five is sanctity versus degradation, one that you see especially on the religious right, but you also see it on the New Age left. You know, ideas about yoga and karma and chakras and toxins. So you find these same five elements mixed together in different proportions all over the world, and then a particular morality has to be based on those foundations.
And the degree in which these five things are at play, and you use the analogy of an equalizer, that the degree to which they're all in play is really what determines whether we're to the right or to the left.
That's right. So if you look at people who are social conservatives, they tend to be more attuned to threat. There's a lot of research, even neuroscientific research, that shows that the minds of conservatives just react more quickly and strongly to threats. And so conservatives tend to be more concerned about threats to the group. They're more concerned about borders, immigration, internal structure, punishing cheaters and criminals. And, you know, I'm a former liberal. I'm in the academic world where everybody's liberal. And, you know, people love to hate conservatives in those worlds. But what I've found in doing this research is conservatives are wise to certain threats that liberals are blind to. And if you don't attend to those threats, your society will fall apart. You just get torn apart and there'll be too much cheating and then people won't want to cooperate. But at the same time, liberals are especially sensitive to issues of care and compassion, and also fairness, especially fairness as a quality and concerns about oppression. They're the experts in noticing who's getting crushed, who's getting left behind, who's getting left out. And if you don't have liberals, you don't notice groups, especially, you know, for example, gay people, handicapped people, people who are really excluded. And it took a long social battle and a legislative battle to get laws changed so that they could participate more in society. So I really come to respect both sides. There's no one correct setting on this moral equalizer. There's no one correct setting that will let you solve all problems. And our society benefits when you have people sort of pushing against each other, arguing for different positions.
Except the kind of conservatism that you're talking about, the more institutionalized conservatism, the more patient conservatism that might have been defined by Oakeshott or Edmund Burke, is very different than some of the conservatism we see played out today.
That's right. There's an interesting book by a political scientist named Karen Stenner, where she shows that in large data sets, you find three different clusters of conservatives, three different types. So the main type is the one you were just talking about. It's the one that has this really long and noble intellectual tradition back to Edmund Burke and in the 20th century Oakeshott and others. And this is the insight that moral order is precious, hard to achieve, and easy to lose. So these are the people, like as William Buckley said in National Review, we stand athwart history yelling stop. I have a great deal of respect for that form of conservatism. Then there are what are called the free market conservatives, but that, you know, people who believe in the free market and don't want a government regulation of the market. Those people should not really be called conservatives. They're only called conservatives because they end up supporting the Republican Party, which is more friendly to the free market. But psychologically, they're not conservative. They're actually more like liberals. They're very open to new experiences and change. They have no problem with change. The third group are what Stenner calls the authoritarians. And these are people who, when they feel that there's a threat from the outside, they want to batten down the hatches, kick out the deviants. These are the people who give conservatives more of a bad name, I think, and who are more racist. The other kinds of conservatives are not particularly racist. And so, yes, there are subtypes on each side. There are also subtypes of liberals, but the subtypes of conservatives are really different from each other.
And where historically there was much more of, or so it seems at least, much more of a yin and yang between the two sides, today each side, particularly the right, seems to be more broken down into its own moral communities within their own framework.
The politics is an ever-shifting game of coalitions, and the right found a kind of a winning formula under Reagan, in which the social conservatives were united with the free market conservatives. And that lasted quite a long time and was very successful. And it was successful because the left had gone so far overboard in the 60s and 70s and cared so little about social order, was so into subverting tradition and changing everything, that Americans got kind of frightened, a lot of Americans. So the conservative coalition lasted quite a long time. It was very successful. And now it's breaking up. And I think it's breaking up in part because the conservatives went too far overboard. And they really appeared heartless and cold and cruel in the last several years. And a lot of Americans, you know, Americans are decent, generally caring people. And I think a lot of them recoiled from the Republican brand. We know that the Republicans have shifted much further right then the Democrats have shifted left over the last 20 or 30 years. The moderate Republicans have largely gone extinct, and I think that they sort of lost their balance, and they really, you know, morality binds and blinds. They got too caught up in Republican orthodoxy or conservative orthodoxy. I think they lost touch with the middle of the country. I think that's what we saw. So I'm hopeful that there will be a lot of changes on the Republican side. I mean, they have an enormously important role to play. As you said, it's a yin-yang formulation. The left tends to push for change, loosen things up. The right tends to push for stability, tighten things up, support order. And you need both sides. And right now, the right has really gone too far overboard, I think.
Talk about it as it relates to generational change, because one of the key components that you talk about in moving to the left is being more open to new experiences. And it's why we see it sometimes younger generations, even younger generations of conservative parents, moving to the left.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, the famous quote from Winston Churchill, a man who is not a socialist or, let's say, leftist at the age of 20 has no heart. The man who is still a socialist or leftist at the age of 30 has no head. It is true that young people tend to, on average, to be more liberal, but then certain life experiences make you more conservative. If you start a business, you suddenly see, you resent the role of government more. You see the need for maintaining order and catching cheaters. You get more conservative. If you have children, you get more conservative. You see the need for authority and order. If you travel abroad, if you spend a semester or a year abroad, you get more liberal. You see that there are other ways to do things. You see the value of other systems. So we do have generational changes, some generational experiences. Those who came of age in the 60s and saw incredible racial injustice and war, that pushed young people generally to the left. The millennial generation is very interesting. I can't tell whether they're more left or right. I think they are they're less moralistic, less dogmatic than the baby boomers were. So I am hopeful that, you know, we went from the greatest generation, which could work together very well, to the baby boomers, who really could not. But as the torch gets passed on to the millennial generation, people in their 20s and even 30s now, as they begin to pick up the torch, I'm hopeful that they'll be less at each other's throats. Their attitude is more, well, who am I to judge? Let's all try to get along and use our social media to link up all over the world. So I think there will be generational change, and I'm a little hopeful about that.
There does seem to be a more pragmatic streak among the millennials. They seem to be better able to get out of that trap of what you talk about in terms of a moral matrix.
Yeah, I think so, because when they were young, you know, 9/11 was one of their defining experiences, and then this long recession. They know that the country is in trouble. They know that their parents and grandparents spent all the money and then took out huge loans and refused to make the hard choices to rein in spending or raise taxes. So they know they're in deep, deep trouble, and they've got to find new kinds of solutions. It's time for some sort of a realignment. I don't know what that's going to be. But I think the young people today they're certainly not buying into the polarities that so defined the culture war in this from the 60s through the 90s. Issues of race and gender that were so central. I think we've made progress on those issues, and they're going to be less central in the coming decades.
And isn't part of that, or seemingly part of it, is kind of breaking down the walls between communities, putting aside some of the tribalism that has been part of, even as you talk about, a consensual hallucination at some points.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If left to our own devices, we tend to self-segregate into communities that see things the way that we do, that agree with us, sort of gated moral communities, you could say. And the internet, of course, it makes it so easy to travel around the world and expose yourself to new ideas. But in fact, people tend to seek out information that confirms their existing biases and prejudices. So there's a lot of research going on now about how people use Facebook and Twitter and whether that isolates people or links them up across divides. And I've seen evidence both ways. You know, in general, people tend to self-segregate, but there are hopeful aspects too. One thing that we're really seeing is geographical sorting. People tend to move to places that share their values. People used to be much more scrambled, both left and right and rich and poor. People lived with people who were not exactly like them, and that's less true now. So that is a disturbing development. Also, we're seeing a big split between urban and rural. In the last election, once your population density, if you live in a place that had a certain population density, whether you lived in a red state or blue state, if it was relatively dense, you voted for Obama, or on average, your group, your town did. But if it was more spread out, you voted for Romney. So we're seeing a big split in this country based on just population density.
What about the conservative attitude in terms of the decay of order and just the natural entropy that we see and how that plays into political debate?
Going back to Edmund Burke, writing in the 1790s about the French Revolution and correctly predicting that when the French revolutionaries, a very left-wing revolution, when they burned up all their structure and order and got rid of all the old order, peace and harmony didn't break out. In fact, mass murder and chaos broke out. And Burke predicted that, and it came true. The right had a great resurgence in the 70s and 80s as order was breaking down in the United States and crime was skyrocketing. And with the crime wave drop in the 90s, that was less threatening. It now looks like, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever read, it looks like the gigantic spike in crime that just came out of nowhere in the 60s and it disappeared in the 90s was due to leaded gasoline. We were basically pumping our kids' brains full of lead in the post-war world. And once we took lead out of gasoline in the late 70s and early 80s, those kids who grew up and came of age of criminal age in the 90s weren't as criminal. They had unleaded brains for the first time in 50 years. So as America's gotten much safer, I mean, I live in New York City now. It's unbelievably safe. I can walk around any time of the day or night. There's no cops, no crime. It's really safe because lead is gone. Young people aren't crazy anymore. And as we've had more order and safety, I think the conservative arguments about the need for order and structure have grown a little less pressing and have made more room for a liberal resurgence.
Jonathan Haidt. The book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It's just out in paperback from Vintage. Jonathan, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Thank you.